How did you know?
Shh, don't talk. You barely have a voice. How did I know which flight you were on? You told me you were landing at 10:30. It wasn't hard to figure out.
You're amazing.
Well, I am a detective, he says with fake modesty.
No, I mean that you're here. I'm so glad to see you.
Oops, that just popped out. Should she have admitted that she's glad to see him, even after he told her he loved her? Probably not, considering that she has no idea how she feels about the revelation. It's not something she spent a whole lot of time thinking about in the last 24 hours, or will be able to think about in the weeks ahead, now that she's the night watchman's next target. Vic said they'll be laying a trap for him, and that they'll keep her safe. Lucinda just wishes she could believe that. A knock on the door jars Vic's attention away from the laptop screen.
Housekeeping,
a male voice calls. Irritated by the interruption, he goes over to the door. Opening it, he realizes belatedly that he should have checked through the peephole, just to make sure it really is housekeeping. A man stands there beside a cart loaded with towels, sheets, toiletries. He has gray hair.
You want turned down?
He asks in broken English. No, thanks. The guy reaches into his pocket. Vic immediately goes for his gun, then sees that the man is holding out a couple of chocolate pillow mints.
Oh, thank you.
Blindly removing a couple of bills from his pocket instead of his weapon, as if the money were what he'd been going for in the first place, Vic thrusts it into the man's hand. Oops. One of the bills is a 10. Grateful he didn't shoot the guy, Vic can't help but smile at his delighted expression.
Oh, thank you, sir, thank you. Thank you very much, here.
He reaches into his pocket again, and this time pulls out a big handful of chocolate mints.
For you, thank you.
You're welcome. Watching him trundle off down the hall with the housekeeping cart, Vic is momentarily amused and glad to have made the guy's night. Then he turns back to the computer screen where he's researching Norway, otherwise known as the Land of the Midnight Sun. The worst part, Cam tells Mike, curled up beside him on the chintz sofa in the sunroom, is that we'll probably never know whether he killed my sister and the others. There's no way to prove that anyone was even on the roof with Ava the night she died, and Lucinda said the figure was hooded in her vision, so she didn't get a look at his face.
I'd say there's enough circumstantial evidence to assume he did it, though.
No, I know. I just wish there were proof. Cam leans her head against his shoulder and yawns.
At least the police said they'll look into it.
Right. But unless they come up with a long-lost signed confession in Stockman's handwriting, I don't see what good it's going to do. She yawns again.
You should go to bed, Mike tells her. It's been a long day.
It has, what with digesting the truth about Stockman, enduring the visit with her father, and hearing from Lucinda that two more people were murdered last night. When Cam went online to read the Seattle newspaper's account of the victims, she was stunned to recognize Kelly Patterson in a photo of her and Julian Dodd snapped during their performance in Guys and Dolls. Kelly was the girl Cam has been seeing in her visions. If only she had known.
But how could you have known?
Exhausted, she stands and stretches.
Are you coming up, Mike?
I'm going to stay here for a few minutes and check the score on the game.
Isn't it over?
Didn't start till 10. They're playing on the West Coast tonight.
He reaches for the remote. And here I thought you were being so noble, spending the whole night playing Scrabble with me and Tess instead of watching baseball.
I was being noble. I was trying to take your mind off everything, and it worked for a while, until you lost.
Yeah, well, you try to win with an X when you can't use it to spell S-E-X.
Mike snickers.
You could have. It's not like Tess has never heard of it.
True. I just hope she isn't thinking about doing it.
Mike covers his ears, Stop that. Go away.
With a yawn, she picks up their empty tea mugs and starts toward the kitchen. In the doorway, she turns back. Mike?
Yeah?
There's just one thing that's bothering me.
You mean besides our 15-year-old daughter and S.E.X.?
He's already flipping channels. I'm being serious here.
So am I.
Mike?
He looks up and sees the look on her face. Okay, what is it?
Someone sent me that note wanting me to make the connection between Sheila Wright and my sister. Before he died, Andrew Stockman must have told somebody what he did. That person is out there somewhere, and he knows what happened to Ava.
He decides not to follow Lucinda Sloan as she leaves the airport with Randy Barricat. No reason to, really. He knows what he came to find out. That she's already aware that she's next. Fear was vivid on her face when she walked through the airport before she spotted Barricat and put on the fake bravado. She's a sitting duck. But she's smart. She'll try to escape. He's smarter. He won't let her.
Vic, did I wake you?
Yes.
Dazed, he sits up in bed, turns on the lamp, sees that it's 3 in the morning.
What's going on, Annabelle?
We've got a match on those old prints. Part 5, 1024. Chapter 24. I still don't understand why the FBI didn't just put this Eugene Fox on America's Most Wanted, Cam tells Lucinda as they stroll through the Reading Terminal Market with little Grace in a baby carriage, a federal agent trailing discreetly behind. He was on the wanted lists after he violated parole last fall, Lucinda tells her around a mouthful of apple dumpling she bought at the Amish stand down the way. But no one realized he was the night watchman for all those years he was in prison, so it wasn't necessarily a big deal. Parole violators are a dime a dozen.
The whole story is unbelievable.
Lucinda couldn't agree more. It's been 3 weeks since Vic told her they'd matched the fingerprints found in Ricky Parker's, a.k.a. Scarlett's, Bronx apartment to Eugene Fox, a mild-mannered young man who lived across the hall with his mother. Born on September 14th, 1950, Fox had led a low-key life before and after, with one exception. As a little boy, he'd been holding his father's hand when a stray bullet hit him during a botched holdup. The father died right there on the sidewalk in front of his son. Something like that will scar a kid for life. Eugene and his mother moved from the Bronx to Yonkers not long after Parker's death, which was, of course, officially unsolved. Eugene worked as an elementary school custodian, kept to himself, took care of his mother. Until, in November of 1969, he was arrested for killing her.
How sure is the FBI that this Fox guy is the night watchman?
Let's put it this way. The date he killed his mother coincides exactly with the murder of Judy Steinberg, the watchman's last known murder.
Neither law enforcement nor the press made a connection between Eugene Fox in Yonkers and Judy Steinberg less than 30 miles, yet a world away, on Long Island.
Why didn't the FBI make this information public then, when they got the fingerprint match?
Lucinda had wondered the same thing at first. Now she tells Cam what Vic and Annabelle told her. They don't want him to know they're onto him. They're almost positive he's going to lay low until June 18th. They know when and where he's going to strike. This is their chance to get him.
And put your life at risk in the process.
Lucinda doesn't reply, spooning the last of the dumpling and rich cream into her mouth, then tossing the plastic bowl into a trash can. She wasn't really hungry, hasn't been lately. But you don't come to the market with its dozens of food stalls without indulging. So she did, to show Cam and the agents, and him, if by chance he's watching, that she's just fine.
Lucinda, I'm worried about you.
It's fine, trust me. I've got so much security right now that whenever I leave my apartment, I feel like the president.
Why do you leave it all? If I were you, I'd hole up until they catch the guy.
No way am I going to be a prisoner in my apartment for almost a month, Lucinda says staunchly. If there's anything I know for sure, it's that this guy doesn't strike in broad daylight in public places. And anyway, the FBI wants me to go about my business as usual, in case he's watching.
Do you think he is?
Lucinda hesitates, then admits it. Yes. I can feel him sometimes.
Now?
No, not now.
Have you seen him?
No, but sometimes I just sense that he's nearby. You know what I mean. Cam nods. She alone knows what Lucinda means.
Aren't you terrified?
Now? No. Like I said, we know when, where, and how he's going to make his move. And these guys are with me all the time.
You're willing to trust them with your life.
They're the FBI, Cam. That doesn't answer the question, but it's the best she can offer.
This is your life, Lucinda, and I don't want anything to happen to you now that everything has finally fallen into place.
Lucinda can't help but smile. Oh, sure. It would have been fine for something to happen to me before, when I was lonely and single. But now that Randy and I are, well, whatever we are. She has yet to put a label on whatever it is they've been doing since she got home from Seattle.
Dating, Cam tells her with a firm nod, then checks her watch.
For that matter, so is Tess, and it's getting late. Late? I feel like you just got here.
That was almost 2 hours ago. It's 3 o'clock, and I don't want to hit rush hour traffic. I've really got to get going home.
So Tess is dating again? She and Mr. Wonderful got back together then?
No, I think she's actually getting over him. This is someone new. His name is Chad, and he invited her to his junior prom.
She's been practicing walking around the house in the shoes she was going to wear, but they're giving her blisters, so I promised I'd take her to look for a new pair tonight. Wow, that's nice of you. My mother would have told me to get out the band-aids and suck it up.
Her mother.
She's been meaning to call Bitsy before, well, before tomorrow. Since she got back from Seattle, she hasn't had a chance.
Who are you kidding?
You've had plenty of chances.
But maybe it's better this way. One less person to have to lie to.
I'm so glad to see Tess smiling again, Cam says. But I'd buy her Manolo Blahnik if I didn't think they'd hurt her feet worse. Anyway, the prom is tomorrow night. They're having a prom on Friday the 13th?
I know, crazy, isn't it? But I didn't want to say anything about it to Tess. I don't think she's noticed the date. Anyway, she's had enough bad luck.
She's not the only one, Lucinda thinks grimly. They make their way toward the exit. Lucinda finds herself scanning the crowd, just in case. She's seen a photo of Eugene Fox, taken just before he was released from prison last June. She made it a point to memorize his features, weathered face, gray hair, and the coldest, hardest black stare she's ever seen in her life. She wants to believe she'd know him if she ever saw him again, but the truth is, he looks like thousands of other middle-aged men. She'd recognize those stony dark eyes anywhere, but the rest of him would be easy enough to disguise simply by gaining or losing weight, dying, shaving, or growing his hair, adding a beard or mustache, wearing sunglasses. Outside Reading Terminal, Cam gives her a hug. She's parked in the garage across the street.
Please be careful.
I really wish people would stop saying that to me, Lucinda tells her as she bends over to press a kiss against little Grace's downy hair.
Trust me, I don't have a death wish. I just hope that when they get this guy, Cam says, they take him alive.
Lucinda doesn't have to ask why. She knows the whole story. Knows that Eugene Fox and Andrew Stockman were in Attica together, in adjoining cells, according to the records Vic found. Eugene Fox might very well be the only person on Earth who can confirm their suspicions that Ava Neary was murdered. Ava and Sandra and all those other girls pictured in the scrapbook he sent Lucinda. If they get him, perhaps they can offer answers to all those grieving, bewildered families, including Cam's. But something tells Lucinda that when June 18th comes, Eugene Fox will never let himself be taken alive, and that he's going to do everything in his power to bring Lucinda down in a blaze of glory with him. FBI, or no FBI. Unmasking the night watchman was a bittersweet triumph for Vic Shattuck. He never imagined that with a name and a face at last, the killer, no longer an unsub, would remain free. Now, with June 18th, just 6 days away, Vic is ensconced in the field office on Arch Street in Philadelphia, working on the Norway angle, which seems to be a frustrating dead end. Missing Kitty like crazy? Worrying about Lucinda Sloane like crazy? Annabelle Wyatt assured him and reassured him that they won't let anything happen to Lucinda. But there are no guarantees. Annabelle knows it. Vic knows it. And he has no doubt Lucinda knows it too. If she has any misgivings, though, they're hidden away as effectively as the watchman himself is. She's willingly going along with Annabelle's plan to set a trap for the night watchman on June 18th, using Lucinda herself as the bait. "Why not consider a decoy?" Vic asked. "We can get an agent who looks like you to take your place."
"Do you think that will work?" Lucinda asked Annabelle.
And Annabelle, damn her, shrugged. "I'll stay," Lucinda decided. "We can't let him slip through our fingers. Either she's the bravest woman Vic has ever known in his life, or the most foolish. Possibly a bit of both. Maybe Lucinda still, somehow, doesn't get it. Maybe she doesn't understand just how clever and cold-blooded a killer the Night Watchman is. Maybe she doesn't grasp how much danger she's in. But Vic does. And he's not going to let another innocent woman die. He tried, early on, to talk her out of this, tried to convince her to go into hiding. She flat out refused. "Something tells me Annabelle wouldn't be thrilled to know you'd even suggested it, Vic," she'd said, wearing an amused little smile. She was right. But he could not, in good conscience, let a woman put her life on the line without at least giving her an out. He suspects he'll live to regret that she didn't take it. She won't, though. Not because Vic might be wrong about what's going to happen on June 18th. Lucinda Sloane won't live to regret it, because she won't live at all. Hearing her mother's heels tapping briskly across the marble corridor, Lucinda turns to see Bitsy Sloane in the doorway of the drawing room. She's dressed, in the middle of a weekday, in a navy silk dress and pearls. Nice to know that some things never change. "Lucinda, what in the world are you doing here?"
"Hello, Mother. I was in the neighborhood, so I thought I'd stop by."
And so the lies begin. Reading Terminal is hardly in the neighborhood. Yet after Lucinda left Cam, she decided that if ever there were a time to reach out to her mother, this is it. Her mother looks at Magdalena, who escorted Lucinda into the mansion after she rang the bell. "Can you please bring us some tea?"
"Right away," the maid nods, then flashes Lucinda a smile. "It's nice to see you again, Miss Sloane."
"You too, Magdalena." "Let's sit down." Bitsy arranges herself on an 18th century French sofa and indicates the chair opposite. "What's wrong?"
What isn't?
If Bitsy were a different kind of mother, and, to be fair, if Lucinda were a different kind of daughter, she might be tempted to pour out the whole story. She might even be tempted to stay. Behind the stone and ivy walls of the Sloane mansion, she feels unreachable, untouchable. That, of course, is the whole idea. Generations of Sloanes before her actually believed that the real world, with all its problems, couldn't penetrate the fortress. But Lucinda never bought into the illusion, and she isn't going to start now. She's here not because it's a safe haven, but because she has something to say. And not much time to say it. It might be now or never. So talk. I've wanted you to know that I've been thinking about how little time we've spent together over the years, Mother. And I want that to change. Bitsy Sloane's perfectly arched eyebrows disappear beneath the bangs of her perfectly styled page boy, yet she maintains her composure as she replies, I see. What made you start thinking about that?
Who knows? Maybe now that I'm in my 30s, I'm finally growing up.
It was a joke, but her mother's response is unexpectedly heartfelt. You've always been grown up, Lucinda. Maybe that was part of the problem.
What do you mean?
You never really needed me.
Oh, Mother, don't.
Please, her mother holds up a hand. Just let me speak, and then you can speak. Who knows? Maybe we'll have an actual conversation. She flashes a grim smile. Again caught off guard, Lucinda returns it. You are always independent, Lucinda. You were determined to take care of yourself from the time you were very young. You didn't need me. And I was relieved, to be perfectly honest, not to be needed. I had my life. Your father had his. You had yours. For a very long time, I thought it worked quite nicely.
I guess maybe it did.
But now, sitting here, shocked to see you appear out of nowhere in the middle of the day, I realize I don't know a thing about what it is that you do exactly, or where and how you live, or who you are.
I really didn't think you wanted to know, Mother.
I didn't. Bitsy shrugs. I'm not going to pretend any differently. Just as I'm sure you don't really want to know what it is that I do, day in and day out, or who I am.
Lucinda opens her mouth to tell her that she does know. But do you?
Maybe we can try to spend some time together then, she tells her mother. Maybe Dad will even join us.
I doubt that.
But maybe. He'll be home on Sunday night for a few days. Why don't you come to dinner while he's here?
Next week?
I can't. Seeing the flash of disappointment in her mother's eyes, she adds, But soon, I promise. Even as she says it, a little voice warns her, You shouldn't make promises you aren't sure you can keep. All right, Frank. I'm going to give you something stronger for the pain. Can you hear me, Frank? If you can hear me, squeeze my hand. He squeezes Angie's hand. Or is it Mary? Frank, if you can hear me, squeeze my hand. He's squeezing, damn it. He probably can, whether he's squeezing or not, another voice says. Hearing is the last thing to go.
Frank, we're making you comfortable. Okay, honey?
Her voice is very far away. I need 10 more cc's, Angie.
10.
Numbers. It's always about the numbers.
Frank, I know it hurts.
Her voice fades before he can tell her that she's wrong.
It doesn't hurt.
Finally, it doesn't hurt at all. As they climb the steps to Neil's house, Randy squeezes Lucinda's hand. I'm starved. How about you?
You know me. I'm always hungry.
Lies. He doesn't know her. He thinks he does, but he doesn't. And she isn't hungry. How can she eat, knowing what's going to happen tomorrow? For once in her life, Lucinda wishes she were enveloped in darkness. That way, Randy wouldn't be able to see her face, and perhaps sense that she's hiding something from him. But the sun is still riding high in the sky, though it's early evening now. Lawnmowers hum, a group of boys play street hockey on a neighboring driveway, and children ride tricycles on the sidewalk as watchful parents chat. It's all so ordinary, such a far cry from the insulated stone mansion Lucinda left behind a little while ago. Fresh from the unexpectedly candid conversation with her mother, She finds herself craving something she didn't even realize was missing.
Family ties. Roots. Ordinary, and thus for her, extraordinary. Everyday life.
Neil opens the door, wearing slacks and a polo shirt.
Lucinda, Randy, glad you could make it. Come on in.
Looking around the front hall, Randy hands him the bottle of wine they brought.
You know, it's been years since I was here, Neil. Oh, well, it hasn't changed much, except that there's a lot more clutter, and some things are a little more worn out, just like the people who live here.
Hey, speak for yourself, Irma appears from the kitchen. It's good to see you again, Randy.
You too, he hugs her.
I hear you retired. Congratulations.
A year ago, but thank you. I just wish Neil would join me. It gets lonely around here.
Randy turns to Neil.
You hear that? Your wife is lonely. Don't you think it's time you threw in the towel?
Not yet, Neil says gruffly.
Then when? Lucinda asks.
When it's time. And that's all I have to say about that.
Irma shakes her head, then gives Lucinda a quick hug. How are you, sweetie? Hanging in there?
She must know what's been going on.
Lucinda figures there are a few secrets between Neil and his wife. Before she can assure Irma that she is, indeed, hanging in there, Garland Fisher steps out of the kitchen.
Irma, don't shoot the messenger, but your rice just boiled all over the stove.
Oh, no, she scurries past him.
Lucinda, I know you've met our neighbor.
Neil gestures at Garland.
He popped over, so I invited him to stay for dinner. Garland Fisher, this is Randy Barraquette.
Nice to see you again, Lucinda. Good to meet you, Randy.
Wearing cargo pants and a khaki fishing hat, Garland shakes both their hands warmly. Lucinda flashes back to the night it all began, remembering how she suspected Garland of stealing the scrapbook. But his eyes are anything but cold and black. How little she knew back then. To think that Eugene Fox was here, in this house with them, that night. He brazenly came in the front door, knocked over the vase and frightened the children, then crept into the kitchen while they were all distracted here. He could have followed Lucinda home, or been waiting in her apartment when she got there. He could have killed her right then and there. But he didn't. He wanted to wait. Timing, after all, is everything. For him.
And for me.
Looking at Randy and Neil, Lucinda can only hope that when the time comes, they'll understand. Trust. That's always been an issue for her. For 3 weeks now, she's been thinking about the handful of people with whom she's entrusted her keys, her secrets, her safety, her heart. Neil, Cam, Randy, even Vic. But when you get right down to it, there's only one person on the face of this earth she's willing to entrust with her life itself. That person is Lucinda Sloane. Chapter 25. On Friday morning, Lucinda calls Randy early, before he can call her. That's unusual.
Hey, why aren't you sleeping in?
He asks, hearing her voice. Didn't feel like it. Are you at work?
Yes, and I definitely could have stood to sleep in after getting home at 1 in the morning. I wish you had let me call in sick today and stay at your place last night like I wanted to.
Another time, she tells him.
Are you still coming out here tomorrow to go to the beach? It's going to be a gorgeous day.
She hesitates. We'll see. Okay. I have to go. I'll talk to you later.
Uh-oh. Something tells Randy she's going to back out. Lucinda? But she's already hung up, and Dan Lambert is standing in the doorway of Randy's office. What's up, Dan?
Seeing the look in his eyes, Randy bows his head. He knows what's coming, but still, it's a blow to hear the words. Frank Santiago died last night.
Tess, did you get the dress on? Do you need help?
Cam calls through the closed door of her daughter's room.
No, you can come in.
She opens the door. Tess stands in front of the mirror, wearing a coral-colored chiffon cocktail dress and the new high-heeled sandals they bought last night, her face made up and her hair in layered waves that fall past her shoulders at last.
Oh, Tess. Do I look okay?
Cam shakes her head.
I don't look okay? No, you do, you do. You look beautiful. And so grown up, I can't believe it. 5 minutes ago, I was pushing you on a swing. Mom, I think that was Grace.
No, that was you.
Trust me. Well, you know what they say, time flies.
Yes, it does, whether you're having fun or not. Looking back over Tess's childhood, Cam thinks of all she missed, lost in a haze of booze and anxiety. And now, look, Tess is a woman. In no time, she'll be gone. Time does fly. It's more precious than Cam ever knew. That's why she's not going to waste another minute dwelling on what happened in the past. What's done is done. You know the truth about Ava. You don't need to hear it from a sick, depraved human being like Eugene Fox. Why give him the satisfaction? It won't change anything. It won't bring Ava back. It's been 35 years. It's time to let go. Cam wipes a tear from her eye.
What's wrong, Mom?
Nothing, she tells Tess. Nothing at all. And she means it. On her knees, pulling weeds from the flower bed beside the front door, Irma looks up in surprise, immediately followed by dread, when Neil pulls into the driveway.
What are you doing home in the middle of the afternoon? Did something happen?
Yes, he steps out of the car. I've made a decision.
Irma stands and pulls off her gardening gloves, brushing dirt from her shorts.
What is it?
I'm going to retire.
Irma breaks into a grin.
Why now?
Neil hesitates. He could tell her about all the missing persons who will never be found, with or without him. He could tell her that last night, just before he crossed the yard to his own empty house, Garland Fisher told him how lucky he is. Or he could tell her about Frank Santiago. Someday they'll talk about all of those things. For now, he just shrugs and says simply,
because it's time.
Lucinda, there you are. I've been trying to call you for the last 2 hours, at home and on your cell. Where have you been?
She ignores Randy's question.
I got your messages. Is everything okay?
I wanted to tell you that Frank passed away last night.
Oh, no.
For a moment, her own troubles disappear.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah,
he sighs.
I've been thinking about something he said to me the last time I saw him. I want to tell you about it. Why don't you drive out here tonight instead of waiting until tomorrow?
Randy, I can't. I'm sorry.
You can't come tonight or you can't come tomorrow?
Both. I just need some time, okay?
Time for what?
She clutches the phone, wishing she could tell him, wishing she could see him, wishing she could say that she loves him too, and wishing he knew the truth. But he can't. Not yet. Not until it comes to an end, one way or another.
Vic, it's Annabelle. I have news and it's not good.
What is it? He sits on the bed in his Philadelphia hotel room and braces himself for the worst.
She's gone.
Excuse me?
She's missing, Vic. We have no idea what happened to her. Nobody's seen her since she got home late last night.
Who? He asks in dread, though he already knows.
Lucinda Sloan.
Elliot Bay is bathed in a pink glow tonight as the sun sinks low in a purplish blue sky,
with the frosty tip of Mount Rainier visible in the distance. Lucinda knew it was out there when she was here last month, but she never got to see it, as it was perpetually shrouded in dense gray clouds. The weather has been beautiful since she landed in Seattle a few hours ago. Maybe it's a good omen. Considering that today is Friday the 13th, she won't count on it. Last night, for the first time in her life, she turned off her bedside lamp. Under cover of darkness, she strapped on her backpack and slipped out the window, closing it after her. As she scuttled away into the night, she expected someone to fall into step behind her. The FBI. Or him. The night watchman. Even though the full moon is still a few days away. But no one followed her. The agents weren't expecting her to turn off the alarms and sneak out the back, giving them the slip. She didn't breathe easily until she'd gotten through security at the airport. Before dawn, she flew from Philadelphia to Chicago. From Chicago, she changed airlines, then flew to Denver. There, she changed airlines for a third time and flew to Seattle. If, by chance, they tail her, they'll think she's retracing the night watchman's steps and that her journey ends here. This is where they'll look for her. But they'll never find her. And neither will the night watchman. Chapter 26. Vic, are you even listening to me? Jarred back to his telephone conversation by Kitty's voice, Vic turns away from the view of Philadelphia's night skyline beyond his hotel room window.
I'm listening.
No, he isn't. He's thinking about the fact that across the ocean in Norway, June 18th has already dawned. Vic is almost convinced that Eugene Fox has abducted Lucinda and somehow taken her overseas. They've got her photo plastered from Oslo to Nordkap, but so far there hasn't been a single sighting. The trouble is, it doesn't make sense for a killer who murders at sundown to transport his next victim to a place where the sun doesn't set at all during the summer solstice. And he was moving from east to west across the United States, from one time zone to the next. If he planned to keep going now that he's finished this continent, wouldn't Alaska or Hawaii be next? Why Norway? Even crossing the Pacific to Asia would make more sense than that. Vic, did you hear me?
No,
he confesses. Sorry, Kitty. She sighs. I'll just let you go. It's late and it's a work night and you're busy.
No, wait. Don't hang up yet.
He needs the connection to his wife. He needs to be reminded that there's a normal life out there waiting for him when this is all over.
What were you saying?
How much did you hear?
Not much.
Kitty sighs. Well, for one thing, Dave Goodlow called today.
Did he ask where I was?
Of course.
What did you tell him?
That you went away to finish your book in peace, and I'm under strict orders not to tell anyone where you are.
Well, it's not a total lie. The second part is true.
He wanted to know if we've given any more thought to a cruise with him and Louise this winter. I said we have, and we'd love to go.
Kitty, I don't know.
Come on, it'll be fun.
It doesn't sound fun, playing bingo with a bunch of old farts and eating at buffets and...
You don't have to play bingo or eat at buffets.
Oh, right. You can play bridge instead and eat in a tuxedo at the same time every night with strangers at your table.
Dave said it's not like that on this cruise line. Norwegian has freestyle dining. You eat wherever you want and whenever you...
What did you say?
I said it's not like that.
Freestyle.
Yes, that's what they call it in the brochure. Didn't you read it?
Freestyle. Norwegian. Kitty, I have to go.
What? Vic?
I'm sorry, I love you. I'll call you back later.
Freestyle. That was the brand of all five watches. Norwegian. Ibsen was a Norwegian playwright. There was a Norwegian krona next to Kelly Patterson's body. All this time, Vic had been thinking of Norway, land of the midnight sun. Heart pounding. He dials Annabelle.
June 18th. Not the longest day of the year, but almost. And it sure has felt like it. All day she's been uneasy. All day she's felt as though he were here with her, watching her. But that, of course, is impossible, unless he's out there floating on an iceberg. Standing on the balcony of her suite, the doors open behind her so that she can listen for the steward's knock. Lucinda watches the sun sink low over the vast Gulf of Alaska. It's almost over. Not just the day, the nightmare. The sun set hours ago in Philadelphia. By now, the FBI will have the night watchman in custody. They would have been staking out her apartment since she left, regardless of the fact that she's not in it. Perhaps they even sent in a lookalike decoy to pose as Lucinda for the past few days. They were undoubtedly lying in wait tonight for the night watchman to make his appearance, and when he did, they would have gotten him. She hopes Vic Shattuck was there to personally slap on the cuffs, or pull the trigger, if that were the case. With any luck, the story will be in the press in a day or two. She'll pick up a newspaper in one of the ports of call. For now, though, she'll stay hidden away in her cabin, where she's been from the moment the ship set sail from Seattle on Saturday morning. Not because she doesn't feel safe here, miles out at sea. This is the last place anyone would ever think to look for her. She never mentioned the rebooked cruise to anyone, having resolved not even to think about it, much less discuss it, until the case was solved. For 5 days now, she's been thinking of Randy. And Neil, too. Constantly. She knows how worried they must be. Wishes she could reach out to let them know she's all right. She doesn't dare. Not yet. Not telling anyone where she was going, or even that she was leaving, has been the most difficult thing she's ever done in her life. It doesn't matter that it was for their own good as much as, or perhaps more so than, her own. It felt wrong. Yet she could never ask or expect Randy or Neil to lie to the FBI. Never. That would have been even more wrong. Hearing a knock on her cabin door, Lucinda steps inside the stateroom, leaving the doors to the balcony open to let in the cool sea air. She's been doing that as much as possible, not accustomed to being cooped up in a small space, day after day like this. She keeps the lights on, of course, as always. All day, all night. The television, too. She likes to keep it tuned to the station that broadcasts the ship's position, the weather, the time. It's nice to keep track of how far they've come, where they are, and how far they still have to go. "Room service," a voice calls. Lucinda peers through the peephole to make sure, feeling a little foolish, as if the night watchman could suddenly beam himself to a ship 3,000 miles away from Philadelphia. Nope, it's the cabin steward who's been taking care of her for 4 nights now. Lucinda opens the door. "How are you, Eduardo?"
"Just fine. You're eating late tonight. I thought you were upstairs at the big chocolate buffet, but maybe you have other plans, eh?"
He gives her a sly look.
"Maybe you're expecting company. I could bring some wine, some champagne."
"No, it's just me." He gives her an, if you say so, shrug that she doesn't really understand. Does he think she has a secret lover stowed away on board?
"Well, if you change your mind, the buffet is the highlight of the cruise. Everyone on the ship is there. Well, almost everyone. It's really something. Chocolate-covered strawberries, chocolate-covered everything you can imagine. Chocolate sculptures, chocolate fountains. Don't you like chocolate?"
"I love it."
"Then you should go."
"Maybe I will. After dinner."
After sunset.
As if reminded why he's here, Eduardo rolls the room service cart, elegantly draped in white linen, into the suite.
"Where would you like this? Would you like to dine outside and watch the sunset? It's beautiful tonight, isn't it?"
She follows his gaze to the balcony. High overhead, the endless arc of midnight blue sky is filled with swirls of clouds,
melding with streaks of reddish orange as the sun descends toward shimmering water. A vivid strip of yellow rides across the horizon, radiating from the sun's fiery dome.
In just a few hours, the sun will be rising again, Eduardo tells her. Have you noticed that it never really gets dark here in Alaska at this time of year?
I have definitely noticed, and that's fine with me.
Why is that?
Because I'm afraid of the dark. He grins at her. Ha, you think I'm kidding, Eduardo.
Then if you ever come to Alaska in the winter, you'd better bring someone to hold your hand, he advises, tongue firmly in cheek. It's just the opposite at that time of year. It never really gets light.
I'll keep that in mind.
Will you be needing anything else?
No, I'm all set. As Eduardo moves to leave, something drops out of his pocket. It's a wad of dollar bills. Watching him scoop up the money, Lucinda wonders if she should be tipping him now. Obviously somebody is. She thought it was policy on this line to wait until the end of the cruise. She'd better double-check that with the concierge in the morning. She locks the door behind Eduardo and slides the chain. There. Safe and sound. Lucinda glances at the television screen with its convenient statistics. They're cruising off the Alaskan coast at 20 knots, having just left Skagway's port at 59.75, 135.53, over 1,000 miles from Seattle, and three times as far from home. It's 10:19 p.m. The sun will set in exactly 5 minutes. Thank God she listened to her instincts and fled Philadelphia last week. Thank God she took charge of her own life, the way she always has. At the open balcony door, the sheer draperies flutter in the stiff wind off the water. Looking uneasily out at the setting sun, she reminds herself that she's safe here. Still, maybe she won't leave the doors open tonight, after all. Come on, that's ridiculous. Buck up. She shivers. It's not just that she's anxious. It gets really cold out here on the water at night. In fact, it isn't all that warm during the day, either. She's spent hours sitting on the teak deck chair, wrapped in a blanket, gazing out at the sea. Hours thinking about what she'll do when she gets back to Philadelphia. About the changes she's already made, the changes she'll continue to make. Her mother was wrong. She hasn't been grown up all her life. She's been a child, willful and carefree. But maybe it's time to grow up. With a sigh, Lucinda glances at the statistics on the television set. It's 10:20 p.m. She looks at the room service cart, wondering why she even bothered to order dinner. And a heavy one at that. Steak, potatoes, salad, dessert. She frowns, realizing there's something extra on the tray, tucked in the shadow of a bud vase amid the silver-domed plates, utensils, cutlery. It's a gift box. They really spoil you in first class. The first night, there was a bottle of champagne from the concierge. The second, a box of chocolate truffles. The third, an invitation to the captain's private reception, to which, of course, she sent her regrets. Last night, a fruit basket. Now what? She eyes the box with apprehension. Today is the 18th. You're confusing premonition with paranoia. Still, the gift is wrapped in shiny red paper and knotted with red ribbon. Red. But lots of gifts are wrapped in red paper. The ship's logo is red. It makes sense. Lucinda picks up the box, feeling foolish for being so hesitant. Come on, what do you think it's going to be? A bomb, courtesy of Eduardo and the night watchman? Tick, 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 sunset, boom. She glances at the open doors. A wedge of sun still sits on the horizon, but it's sinking fast. Open the damned present. At least it's something to do. It'll take your mind off everything. Lucinda slices the ribbon with the steak knife, tears off the paper, opens the lid.
and the world skids to a screeching halt.
Randy's footsteps are hollow on the hardwood floors of Lucinda's apartment as he walks through the rooms, taking one last look around as the FBI support agents pack up. June 18th came and went without a visit from the night watchman, without a sign of Lucinda. Eugene Fox must have abducted her days ago, catching her off guard. It shouldn't have, though. Lucinda was wary. She knew she was a target. The FBI was here, ready for anything. Not Vic Shattuck, though. He'd been taken off the case. That was a surprise. Randy had expected him to see it through, for Lucinda's sake, if nothing else. He didn't even say goodbye before he left. It's been a rough couple of days, coming to terms with the fact that Lucinda is gone. Randy kept thinking that maybe she had run off of her own accord, that the watchman would show up here tonight after all. They were ready. The whole damned neighborhood was staked out. The apartment was occupied by a decoy who, at least from a distance, looks like Lucinda. At 8:32, they waited, all of them, holding their breaths. Waited. Waited. All night into the morning. Randy stops pacing, leans his forehead against the wall in despair. Lucinda. How the hell did the watchman get to her last week, when she was under surveillance, behind locked doors? How did he slip past the agents? How did he disarm the alarm? Does it matter? It's June 19th. The sun will rise in a few hours. It's too late for Lucinda. Trembling, Lucinda lifts the wristwatch from the box. The hands are stopped at 10:24. She turns it over. June 18th, 135.5, 59.7. Surprise, a voice croons out of nowhere, and she looks up to see a figure standing at the balcony door, silhouetted against the setting sun. Cam cracks the door to the nursery. She can see Grace asleep in her crib, bathed in the nightlight's pink glow. Satisfied, she closes the door and slips over to Tessa's room. No nightlight here, but the shades are up. Light from the fat full moon illuminates the room. Tess, too, is sound asleep in her bed. She looks so sweet and innocent in slumber, like a little girl again. So different from the young woman who, just days ago, attended her first prom and came home head over heels in love, again. Cam closes the door and tiptoes past the master bedroom, where she left Mike snoring. All is well in the Hastings home tonight. She just had to be sure, even though she was well aware that the reason she hasn't been able to sleep tonight has little to do with anything going on under her own roof. It's Lucinda. Sometime after Cam left her on Thursday afternoon, she disappeared. Neil Bullard told Cam that the FBI believes she might have been abducted by the night watchman. No, that's not what happened. Cam is certain Lucinda took matters into her own hands. She's alive, gone into hiding. Cam has a strong sense that she's somewhere out west, somewhere overlooking the water. But she hasn't told a soul about her psychic impressions, not even Neil Bullard or Randy Barricat. There's a reason Lucinda didn't tell anyone where she was going. If Cam is right and Lucinda is safe, then they'll all find out soon enough. And if she's wrong, until tonight she didn't think that was possible, so powerful was her intuition. But as she lay in bed trying to fall asleep, an equally powerful sense of foreboding crept over her. Be safe, Lucinda, wherever you are. Of all the great moments in Eugene Fox's life, his vengeance on Scarlet, his release from prison, his initial discovery of Lucinda Sloane, this is, by far, the greatest. Even she, the all-knowing psychic detective, with all her supernatural powers, is no match for him. She thought she was so smart, running away. She thought she had outwitted them all. But she herself has been outwitted by the master. Her brilliant idea was his own. He controls not just her movements, but her thoughts, as he set out so long ago to do. He booked the cruise for Lucinda months ago and reserved a room for himself right next door, with the adjoining balconies separated by a thin plexiglass wall. Crossing over the rail from one to the other was laughably simple. He knew all along that he'd have her right where he wanted her when the time came. Knew her better than she knew herself. So distracted was she by his other maneuvering that she didn't think to question the letter from the cruise line. She accepted it as authentic. The night she called him, directly, to confirm, it was all he could do not to burst out laughing right then and there on the telephone. He controlled himself then. And so he will now, until it's over. Though laughter is already beginning to bubble inside him as he stands face to face with her at last, seeing the look of sheer dread and shock on her beautiful face, he moves toward her. What's the matter, Lucinda? Didn't you know that I always get the last laugh? Do you want some more coffee? Irma asks Neil, sitting beside him on the couch in their living room. No, thanks. He checks his cell phone for the 1,000th time, as if he could possibly have missed a call. If I have any more coffee, I think I'll be sick.
Do you want to try to get some sleep?
Neil shakes his head.
I don't think I can.
Irma rests a hand on his shoulder.
You don't know that Lucinda isn't out there somewhere, waiting it out. It would be just like her to take matters into her own hands.
I wish I could buy that she'd just take off without telling us.
You don't?
Neil shrugs. Something he heard Lucinda say a while back has been echoing through his thoughts for days now, since she vanished.
A secret isn't a secret, unless you're the only one who knows.
I wouldn't do that if I were you.
About to make a run for the door behind her, Lucinda sees the gun in his hand and goes absolutely still.
Move a muscle and I'll shoot you dead.
No, you won't.
What?
His cold, dead eyes gleam with interest.
You don't believe you're about to die? Why do you think I'm here, then?
To share the view? He laughs. Her blood runs cold. She knows that sound. She's heard it for months now, echoing through her thoughts, through her nightmares.
Keep him talking.
You're not going to shoot me.
That's not what you do, Eugene.
The laughter subsides.
So we're on a first-name basis, are we?
Absolutely. Call me Lucinda. Unless you'd prefer Scarlet.
The black eyes narrow.
You don't want to use a gun, she tells him,
noting the sliver of sun just barely visible above the water behind him.
That wouldn't be any fun. You want to stab me. I know you have a knife.
You think you know everything? Guess what? You don't.
And neither do you.
Keeping her voice, her gaze, her hand steady, she eggs him on.
Oh, I think I do. I know things about you that nobody else on Earth knows.
Like what?
I know that you're the night watchman. I know that you watched your father die at your feet when you were a child. I know that you killed your own mother, and Ricky Parker, and Andrew Stockman.
Only at the last name does he raise an eyebrow. It was a guess on her part, but clearly a good one.
He died during the uprising. Dozens of inmates did. You don't know anything.
Really? I think you seized the opportunity to kill him yourself and make it look that way.
It's a hunch she's had ever since Cam told her about Stockman. Judging by Eugene's expression, she's on the right track.
Why would I kill that nobody?
He asks in disdain. This is your chance to learn the truth for Cam. But when this is over, will you even be alive to tell her?
Over his shoulder, she sees the sun slipping dangerously close to the horizon.
Keep him talking.
Maybe you killed him because you felt threatened by him, Eugene.
He was bigger and stronger and smarter than you.
That's a joke. He was a peon. He bragged about all those girls he'd killed, every detail, went on and on about them all day, all night, talking like he was so bold.
He was bold. Brave, too. Lucky. Not like you. He got away with it.
That shows how smart you are, he scoffs. You know why he went after them? Because they wouldn't give someone like him the time of day. So you know what he did? He made them all look like suicides. Didn't even have the guts to own it.
Not like you.
Damn right.
The last rays of the sun have all but disappeared. I bet you told him how to do things the right way.
Hell yes, I told him.
And then you realized he knew too much. So you killed him.
Suddenly, Fox follows her gaze over his shoulder.
Sunset.
It's time, Lucinda.
He moves toward her. She forces herself to stand her ground, seeing the knife that's replaced the gun in his hand. And the lipstick.
It's time for you to die.
Back in Philadelphia, Vic learned that being FBI doesn't mean you're granted immediate access to the ship's manifest. By the time he'd landed in Alaska, Annabelle had confirmed that Lucinda is, indeed, a passenger on the Norwegian Star.
What about Eugene Fox? That's anyone's guess,
Annabelle replied.
Who knows what name he's traveling under?
Even now that Vic is here on the ship, having gained the necessary clearance to board in Skagway before they set sail an hour ago, there's a hell of a lot of red tape involved in getting to Lucinda. He had expected to reach her well before sunset. It didn't happen. As he races up the wide staircase toward Deck 11 with the head of security by his side, Vic looks at his watch. It's 10:24. Lucinda remains motionless until the last possible second. Then she makes her move, lunging right toward him, not away. Caught off guard, he instinctively raises the knife. So many times in her visions of the women murdered by the night watchman, Lucinda's ears have been assaulted by the dull, sickening sound of a blade thudding into human flesh. Now she hears it for real. Feels the blood spatter over her, sees her hands red with blood. It's too late.
Where is it? Where's her cabin?
Vic demands, taking the last flight two steps at a time.
That way,
the security guard pants.
To the left.
Vic races toward it, praying that it's not too late. Eugene Fox staggers back, looking bewildered. Glancing down, he sees the steak knife's blade protruding from his chest. He looks up at Lucinda, raises the gun, aims it at her, pulls the trigger. Nothing happens.
Maybe I don't know everything, Lucinda tells him. But I knew there was no way you could have gotten a real gun on board this ship. And like I said, I know that isn't how you operate.
A sound comes out of him. For a moment, she thinks it's a sob or a cry of pain. Then she sees the look on his face and realizes that he's laughing, even as he collapses on the floor of her cabin. The sound seems to chase her as she dashes out into the hall, looking for help. Incredibly, help appears. Lucinda stops short in disbelief.
Vic? Lucinda, are you hurt?
She follows his gaze, looks at her hands.
No, this is his. He came at me and I stabbed him. He's in my room.
Vic doesn't ask who she's talking about.
All right, stay here. You too,
he instructs the security guard who's caught up with him. Vic moves stealthily past her and stands with his back against the wall, gun poised, beside the open doorway.
After a few moments, he peers around the corner into the room. He takes in the scene for a moment, then crosses the threshold. Heart pounding, Lucinda waits outside her room with the guard, expecting Eugene Fox to emerge bleeding from his chest wound, like something out of a horror movie. A minute passes. Another. Just when she can no longer take it, Vic calls her name, tells her to come in. Fox must be dead. Thank God. Lucinda walks into the room to see Vic standing just inside the door, facing the open balcony doors. He's gone.
What? He can't be gone.
Lucinda looks around wildly.
He was right.
She sees the bloody steak knife lying on the floor where she left him, sees the trail of blood from there to the balcony, sees beyond the drapes billowing in the sea breeze against the backdrop of the twilight sky, the railing smeared with red. Epilogue. Vic can hear Kitty vacuuming the living room as he sits down at his desk.
Will the noise bother you?
She asked when he announced he was going to go work on the book. The only thing that could bother me right now, he told her, would be my being anywhere other than here with you. She smiled.
It's good to have you home.
It's good to be home. He boots up the computer and opens the document he left behind weeks ago when he went off to try to alter the ending in real life. Now, facing the final chapter again, he thinks about Eugene Fox, the man who seemed to fall off the face of the earth, only to resurface and begin killing again. What if? No.
Still.
You don't really believe the Night Watchman survived, do you? He asked Lucinda on the phone last night.
No, she said. I don't.
Because you're a psychic?
Because I can't let myself believe he's out there somewhere, she said firmly. I refuse to go through life always looking over my shoulder. It's time to move on.
Yes, it is. Scrolling to the last chapter, Vic thinks of the ending he'd wanted to write, the one in which he, Vic Shattuck, brought the Night Watchman to justice at last. He thought it would have made a great final scene for the movie. His agent thinks that what happened in real life will make a better one. This way, it's open-ended. The guy is stabbed in the chest, staggers to the railing, and falls overboard, lost at sea. Or is he? She added ominously. Oh, come on. You don't really think anyone's going to believe the Night Watchman survived the fall into the ocean, do you? His body still hasn't been found. That doesn't mean he's still alive out there somewhere. No, but it leaves one hell of a good opening for a sequel. Well, you'll have to find someone else to write it, Vic told her, because I'm going to be busy. Doing what? He grinned. A whole lot of nothing. You've been so quiet tonight, Randy tells Lucinda as they walk the beach, hand in hand, beneath the light of a waning moon. Don't tell me you've lost your voice again. Lucinda smiles. Not this time. I guess you've just said all there is to say then.
I guess so.
She squeezes his hand.
Except one thing.
Yeah? What's that?
Remember a few weeks ago when I was in Seattle, and we were on the phone, and you told me something you'd been waiting to say for a long time, but you didn't give me a chance to respond?
I remember.
Can I respond now?
That would be good. That would be really good. They stop walking. She looks up at him.
I love you, Randy. I've always loved you. I just didn't know it. Or maybe I just didn't know how to say it. Or maybe the time wasn't right. It was too late, or too soon.
Not anymore.
No, not anymore.
He kisses her. Stay with me, Lucinda. He doesn't say tonight. He doesn't mean tonight. She knows that.
knows, too, that there are no guarantees. I'll stay, she says softly, and the tide comes in, washing over their bare feet as they head back. That night, climbing into bed beside Randy, she turns off the bedside lamp. You're not afraid of the dark anymore? He asks, surprised. I'm not afraid of anything anymore. Lucinda falls asleep in Randy's arms, dreaming again about the wooden jigsaw puzzle. Only this time, all the pieces are there. As she fits the last piece into place, she sees the complete picture at last. It's Lucinda herself, smiling, as behind her, the sun rises over the Atlantic. This concludes the reading of Dead Before Dark by Wendy Corsi Staub. Copyright 2009 by Wendy Corsi Staub. This book was read by Emily Sutton Smith. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Curtis Brown Limited and was produced in 2019 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.